The first two paragraphs of the second chapter give a statement of the theorem of the life divine. The second chapter, first two paragraphs. The first paragraph is a summary of the first chapter as a whole. That is to say, what have we arrived at the end of the first chapter? It is the affirmation of our divine life upon earth and an immortal sense in mortal existence. This is the conclusion that was reached at the end of the first chapter. Now, if you want to continue with this affirmation, Sri Aurobindo says, this affirmation can have no base unless we recognize not only eternal spirits as the inhabitant of this bodily mansion, the weaver of this mutable robe, but accept matter of which it is made as a fit and noble material out of which he, the spirit, weaves constantly his garbs, builds recurrently the unending series of his mansions. That is to say, we have to accept both eternal spirit and matter. As we see, the chapter number 2 is entitled The Two Negations. And the subtitle of this chapter is The Materialist Denial. That is to say, although we are required to affirm both spirit and matter, if divine life upon the earth is going to be realizable, we have an immediate negation. And the first negation comes from the materialist. The materialist denies the existence of the spirit. In the next chapter, we shall have the denial of matter. And the fourth chapter is entitled The Omnipresent Reality, a reality which synthesizes both the spirit and matter. So in this chapter, the emphasis is upon the consideration of the refusal or the denial of the materialist. How far the denial of the materialist is valid, whether it is sustainable, if not, in what sense it is not. Are we going to reject the materialist totally, partly, partially, or to some extent, or not at all? These are the questions that this chapter concentrates upon. Now Sri Aurobindo goes farther and says, it is not enough merely to accept that spirit is real and matter is real. This is not enough. We have to go farther. What is that farther? Nor is this even enough to guard us against a recoil from life in the body, unless with the Upanishad, perceiving behind their appearances the identity and essence of these two extreme terms of existence, we are able to say in the very language of these ancient writings, matter also is Brahman, and to give its full value to the vigorous figure by which the physical universe is described as the external body of the divine being. That is to say, we have to not only affirm the reality of spirits and reality of matter, but we have to even say that there is an essential identity between spirit and matter, a proposition that we find in the Upanishads. And Sri Aurobindo also cites another sentence of the Upanishad, that the whole universe is the external body of the divine being. Ishavasyam idam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam jagat. The whole universe is the habitation of the divine being. We need to go farther, because between matter and spirit, there are many intermediate stages. And philosophy, as we have said, is an account of the totality, all the elements of the universe. You remember we said that there is today a philosophical doctrine which maintains that we don't need to explain anything. The very idea of explanation itself is beside the point. You simply have to see the world, describe the world as it is, and whatever happens, happens. Do not ask the question why it should happen, what is the cause of it, how it has happened. All this is not required. You simply have to describe what is happening. We have considered this possibility and said that that is one way of looking at the world. But if you have a better view of the world, we should consider a better view of the world. That is to say, chance may not be the explanation of the world. And you said if chance is the reality, it is by chance that their theory is right. Not because of any other reason, but by chance that theory happens to be right. Therefore, we are trying to see another alternative. Can we explain the world at all? Either we don't explain anything at all and leave the world as it is, and just watch what is happening. And whatever happens, happens by chance, so there is nothing to consider. You just be witness of the world as it is happening. If you like to participate in it, participate in the way in which you like. Don't participate if you don't like. Ultimately, there is nothing in the world. There is no significance in the world. The chance theory has no significance. As Sri Aurobindo points out, it may be that the world has no significance. It's quite possible. That is, philosophically, it is one way of looking at the world, but it is not the rational way. That is the important point. The rational way is the way by which you find the meaning, significance. So, but maybe the rational way itself may be a wrong way. Therefore, we are considering the other alternative. It is quite possible that we can explain the whole world. And this is the whole attempt of the life divine. The life divine is a rational assurance that spirit will manifest in the human body fully. This is the theorem, you might say, the basic proposition. The spirit will manifest in the body fully, omnipotently. This is the whole thesis. Now, the whole life divine is a rational proof of it. And it is for that reason that this labor is undertaken. It is for those who want to understand rationally the rationale of the world. That is to say, those who admit that philosophy as an explanation is a justifiable exercise. So, having stated that if spirit is going to manifest in matter, then we have to admit the reality of spirit, admit the reality of matter. We have to admit the not only the reality of spirit and matter, we have to go one step further and maintain that spirit and matter are essentially identical. Unless we do this, our thesis will not be sustained. Sri Aurobindo says we have to go farther. The distance between spirit and matter in our experience is so great, and between matter and spirit there are many other facts of existence, that we have to show a real linking between matter and spirit. So this is what Sri Aurobindo says in the next sentence. Nor, so far divided apparently are these two extreme terms, is that identification convincing to the rational intellect if we refuse to recognize a series of ascending terms, life, mind, supermind, and the grades that link mind to supermind, between spirit and matter. We have to admit the linking of this series. Otherwise, the two must appear as irreconcilable opponents bound together in an unhappy wedlock, and they divorce the one reasonable solution. To identify them, to represent each in the terms of the other, becomes an artificial creation of thought, opposed to the logic of fact, and possible only by an irrational mysticism. This is what you might say is a theorem of the whole book. To recognize the essential identity of matter and spirit, and secondly, to show the linking between matter and spirit, link being the supermind, mind, and life. These are the links between spirit and matter, and these links also have to be shown. In other words, the entire universe is to be analyzed properly, and then only we shall be able to get at the affirmation, rational affirmation, of the manifestation of the spirit and body. Now, the next paragraph is an extremely difficult paragraph, and it presupposes a great deal of the knowledge of history of philosophy. We shall still read it because, after all, it is not so difficult. If we assert only pure spirits and a mechanical, unintelligent substance or energy, calling one God or soul and the other nature, the inevitable end will be that we shall either deny God or else turn from nature. Now, this is a thesis and also an answer. That is to say, if we affirm only pure spirit, if you say there are only two realities, God and nature, both real, this is what has happened in Jainism. This is also the case of Sankhya. In the history of philosophy, these two philosophies are very powerful. The philosophy of Sankhya, according to which there are only two principles of existence. The soul and nature, Purusha and Prakriti. Jainism also accepts the multiplicity of souls and matter, jada tattva. So Sri Aurobindo says, if we assert only pure spirit, you may call spirit by the name of spirit or God or whatever other name you give to the idea of spirit, but if we affirm only spirit on one side and mechanical energy, matter on the other, as the two ultimate realities, Sri Aurobindo states that in due course of time, or in logical thinking, ultimately we should be led to affirm one or the other, either in metaphysics or in ultimate aim of life. If we assert only pure spirit and a mechanical, unintelligent substance or energy, calling one God or soul and the other nature, the inevitable end will be that we shall either deny God or else turn from nature. In Sankhya, having affirmed Purusha and Prakriti as the two ultimate realities, the conclusion that ultimately came was that we have to reject Prakriti and return to the soul. In Jainism also, we have to reject matter and turn to the soul. In the matter of metaphysical thought, when the two positions are described, this is real, this is real, both are real. Can we maintain this dualism right up to the end? Or we shall be obliged to bring them together into one unity? In practice, we see that even though we regard in Jainism or in Sankhya the two realities, Purusha and Prakriti, as the two ultimate realities, both these philosophies maintain, although both are real, you must reject matter. You cannot throw out from existence matter, but you should be able to withdraw from matter totally. Why, if both are real, why should we not be able to embrace both? This is the question we should ask both Sankhya and Jainism. But the answer is that also Purusha and Prakriti, or Jiva and Jada, are two ultimate realities. One is superior to the other. Both are real, but one is superior. Now, how did you arrive at this sense of superiority? If both are real and both are ultimate, both are self-existent, how do we arrive at this concept of superiority? And why should one be superior to the other? If both are unrelated in any way, why do you make this relationship of superiority? So why do you make a choice? So Sri Aurobindo says that both these philosophies have turned to deny nature in one way or the other. If not deny the truth of nature, at least by saying it is inferior. And in that sense, it's a rejection of matter. For both thought and life, a choice becomes imperative. Thought comes to deny the one as an illusion of the imagination, or the other as an illusion of the senses. This is what is an argument, basic argument, in the Vedantic philosophy, which has been propounded by Shankaracharya. That is to say, thought comes to deny the one as an illusion of the imagination, or the other as an illusion of the senses. If you read the Bhashya of Shankara on Brahma Sutra, the conclusion has been drawn. Shankaracharya considers the Sankhyan philosophy, Purusha and Prakriti, as the two ultimate realities. And he comes to the conclusion that the Brahman, the spirit, is real, and matter is simply a hallucination of the senses. On the other hand, if you read the philosophy of materialism, it says that matter is real, and what you consider to be the spirit is only a false illusion of imagination. You imagine the spirit, actually spirit doesn't exist. These are the two alternative conclusions which are drawn in the history of thought. Thought comes to deny the one as an illusion of the imagination, or the other as an illusion of the senses. Life comes to fix on the immaterial and flee from itself in a disgust or a self-forgetting ecstasy, or else to deny its own immortality and takes its orientation away from God and towards the animal. That is to say, as in the case of Jainism and Sankhya, although both are regarded as real, as far as life is concerned, life is required to deny the material existence and flee from material existence. Life comes to fix on the immaterial, on the Purusha, or on the Jiva. Life comes to fix on the immaterial and flee from itself in a disgust or a self-forgetting ecstasy, or else to deny its own immortality and take its orientation away from God and towards the animal. That is what materialist does. Purusha and Prakriti, the passively luminous soul of the Sankhyas, and their mechanically active energy have nothing in common. This is the basic reason. Why this choice becomes necessary? Because they have nothing in common. If there was something common, you would have been obliged to keep them together. But since there is no commonality, ultimate logical conclusion comes about in rejecting one or the other. They have nothing in common, not even their opposite modes of inertia. Purusha is inert, Prakriti also inert, and although that is inertia, but that inertia is not exactly identical. Inertia of matter and inertia of Purusha, they are not identical, there is nothing common between the two. Their antinomies can only be resolved by the cessation of the inertly driven activity into the immutable repose upon which it has been casting in vain the sterile procession of its images. So the conclusion could be only to run away from the Prakriti or energy and to seek repose in the spirit. Shankara's wordless, inactive self and his Maya of many names and forms are equally disparate and irreconcilable entities. Their rigid antagonism can terminate only by the dissolution of the multitudinous illusion into the sole truths of an eternal silence. Therefore, whether we take the position of Sankhya, which states that Purusha and Prakriti are two realities. Even Shankara's philosophy maintains that there is spirit and there is Maya. Although Maya has ultimately no reality, it has vyavaharik satta. But even that vyavaharik satta ultimately has to be eliminated. Ultimate conclusion would be, you are forced to conclude that you have to choose between the two because there is nothing common between them. So the choice becomes imperative. Now, this is for those who happen to choose the spirit. But the other way also is possible. If you say that matter is much more attractive, then you take a materialistic position. Even if you start by saying that both spirit and matter exist, ultimately, materialist will choose matter as the ultimate reality. It will reject the other. The materialist has an easier field. This is a very important sentence. The materialist has an easier field. There is a very interesting dialogue in the history of philosophy between Berkeley was a philosopher, and he is regarded as a philosopher of the spirit who denies the existence of matter. And he wrote a dialogue between Hylas and Philonous. And one of them is a spiritualist, another is a materialist. And Berkeley tried to prove that only spirit exists. And then the opponent simply kicks a football and says, "What is this?" He has an easier field. The matter is very easy to show as real. You can kick a football and prove the existence of matter. So you might say that materialist has an easier field. For the one who believes in spirit, he has to do a lot of reasoning to show that this matter really does not exist. And you have to make a very long chain of reasoning to point out what is hallucination and how the senses are deceptive and how the illusions arise. And then spirit, which is not visible at all, to make it real, is a very, very difficult process. But for those who want to prove the existence of matter, it is as easy as to kick a football. To say, here is matter. How can you deny it? So Sri Aurobindo says, the materialist has an easier field. It is possible for him, by denying spirit, to arrive at a more readily convincing simplicity of statement. A real monism, the monism of matter, or else of force. But even if you do so, in this rigidity of statement, it is impossible for him to persist permanently. Even though materialists might say that he has won the game, when you ask the question, "Please tell me what is matter," and he goes on explaining to you, then ultimately what is the end of his argument? He is led to conclude, he too ends by positing an unknowable, as inert, as remote from the known universe, as the passive Purusha or the silent Atman. Because if you ask the question, what is matter, you will find that you are bound to posit something that is invisible. Go on deeper and deeper to the atomic and molecules, and deeper and deeper roots, you find something invisible. And that invisible to show that that invisible has become visible in this form, that seems to be a miracle. How that visible has become visible in this form, how has it happened, that becomes impossible. So Sri Aurobindo says that even he too ends by positing an unknowable as inert, as remote from the known universe, as a passive Purusha or the silent Atman. It serves no purpose but to put off by a vague concession the inexorable demands of thought, or to stand as an excuse for refusing to extend the limits of inquiry. Both the spiritualist has to explain that if matter is unreal, how has it come about? He can only refuse the inquiry. He can simply say it has come about. It's a hallucination. You don't need to explain. So he refused the inquiry. The materialist also, if you say how that invisible ultimate atomic and subatomic particle has become this visible reality, even this he can only say, now don't ask me those questions, I cannot inquire into it. So ultimately both of them come to the conclusion, you stop inquiry. This is what it is. So in other words, thought is to be excised. Rationality is to be excised. Therefore, in these barren contradictions, the human mind cannot rest satisfied. It must seek always a complete affirmation. This is the very starting point of philosophical thinkings. Philosophy is a rational inquiry, and reason demands comprehensiveness. You might say this is something that you cannot cut out of the reason. If you make one statement, reason will demand how that statement stands in relationship with other statement, and that with another statement. And this cannot end unless you take the whole universe, all the facts together. The moment you start denying one against the other, this problem will reappear. There are two facts, spirit and matter. If the two facts exist, you have got ultimately to realize that the two have to be reconciled. Therefore, in these barren contradictions, the human mind cannot rest satisfied. It must seek always a complete affirmation. It can find it only by a luminous reconciliation. To reach that reconciliation, it must traverse the degrees which our inner consciousness imposes on us, and whether by objective method of analysis applied to life and mind as to matter, or by subjective synthesis and illumination, arrive at the repose of the ultimate unity without denying the energy of the expressive multiplicity. This is the conclusion you'll be obliged to arrive at. You may arrive at it by proceeding on the scientific, what is called scientific method, or you may arrive at it by mystic method, subjective method. In the case of yoga, you start with the subjective method. You try to develop your consciousness and refine it more and more and arrive at the experiences of the spirit, and then try to relate that spirit with matter. Or you start with matter, analyze life, analyze mind, and then try to arrive at something that is beyond matter, life and mind. That method may be an objective analytic method. This may be a synthetic or scientific, the synthetic method or subjective method. By both the methods ultimately, you arrive at the same conclusion, same confirmation. Only in such a complete and cathartic affirmation can all the multiform and apparently contradictory data of existence be harmonized, and the manifold conflicting forces which govern our thought and life discover the central truth which they are here to have symbolized and variously fulfilled. Then only can our thought, having attained a true center, ceasing to wander in circles, work like the Brahman of the Upanishad, fixed and stable even in its play and its worldwide coursing, and our life, knowing its aim, serve it with a serene and settled joy and light, as well as with a rhythmically discursive energy. When our philosophical thought is able to reconcile matter and spirit, then two consequences will follow. Thought becomes silent, and life becomes systematically organized. Till that time, if you reject matter and turn to spirit, life is shriveled up. If you follow only matter and reject the spirit, life becomes wild. No system. You can move and wander about in material life. There is no systematization of life. There is no rhythm in life. There is no fundamental experience of the multifarious possibilities of life movement. Similarly, if there is a rejection of spirit, if there is rejection of matter, not spirit, if rejection of matter, then mind may be forced to be silent. It does not become stabilized. It is forced to be silent. And life is excised willy-nilly. This is the experience of all ascetic life. All the opportunities of life are thrown out of their gear. In other words, if you really want thought to be steady and quiet, if you want life to be rhythmic and systematic, this can happen only if we have that harmony of spirit and matter which we have in the Upanishad. In the Upanishad, the reality which has been described is a synthetic reality. The Isho Upanishad describes the synthesis perfectly well. It moves not. That is the nature of ultimate reality. Tad ejati, tad na ejati. It moves not. And it is that reality which is beyond any division, and yet it is that which moves out into multifarious realities of the world. It is only when you can put these two together in a synthetic manner that thought becomes steady, not only silent but steady, and life begins to have a dance which is systematic and full. Now, up till now, we have seen that if you start with the statement that matter is real and spirit is real, both are real, but if you are not able to reconcile together in a systematic manner, then the choice becomes imperative. Either you become a realist, materialist, or you become idealist or a spiritualist. And in neither of these two, ultimately you will find a reconciliation and ultimate satisfaction. Now in the next paragraph, we have a psychological account of the history of human thought. What Sri Aurobindo says is that there was, at the very beginning of history of thought, a synthesis. Sri Aurobindo does not here refer to the Veda and the Upanishad by name, but psychologically he refers to them, that to begin with, there was a harmony of spirit and matter, both in the Veda and the Upanishad. But that harmony of the Veda and Upanishad was disturbed. When that disturbance takes place, then what is the method by which we can return to that synthesis which we have lost? The entire history of thought, entire history of life in a sense, you might say, is a history of a disturbance. There was a harmony in the thought and life of the Veda and the Upanishads. That harmony got lost. There was something that happened. It was lost. When it is lost, psychologically, how do you recover it? The method is a gradual return. And in the movement of a gradual return, you are obliged to make a test. Is matter the sole reality? Is life the sole reality? Is mind the sole reality? Is spirit the sole reality? This kind of a search becomes inevitable. If you start with a state of disturbance, you go to every station, important station, and ask whether that is the terminal point. You have lost the terminal point, which was the starting point, was the reconciliation of spirit and matter. That is disturbed. Then you are obliged to ask each one of the elements as if it is terminal point, and ask, is matter terminal? Is life terminal? Is mind terminal? Is spirit terminal? It is again when you see all of them and you linger on each station for quite some time, and it's a history of thought. History of thought, therefore, has taken different positions. At one time it has said matter is the only reality. Sometime it has said life is the only reality. Sometime it has said mind is the only reality. Sometime it has said spirit is the only ultimate reality. It is when all these four elements have been first put on the throne and each one has been found to be inadequate that you can then come back to the return of reconciling all of them together. This is the entire account of the history of thought, Eastern and Western. We all have tried out knocking the door and tried to see the world in one form or the other. In this movement, the two movements which have lingered most are the position of materialists, which regards matter as the only principle by which everything can be explained, or spirit, according to which spirit is the only reality by which everything can be explained. These two positions have remained longer. But even these positions have given way. Today we stand at a stage where both spirit and matter, even though they have lingered for a long time, they both have come to a conclusion that they are inadequate. If we emphasize spirit and deny matter, this is the conclusion. If we emphasize matter and deny spirit, then this is the conclusion. And Sri Aurobindo said, India has made a great experiment in affirming the spirit and denying matter. Europe has made a great experiment in affirming matter and denying the spirit. And both have come to the conclusion that India has suffered, Europe also has suffered. And both of them are now looking forward to a point as to how they can learn from each other and how they can reconcile the two positions together. Now this next paragraph is psychological analysis and quite a difficult paragraph, but I'll go through it because we are taking a study of the life divine, so we must know what this book contains. So I'm not passing over saying it is very difficult, we shall not go through it, but let us read it. But when that rhythm has been disturbed, it is necessary and helpful that man should test separately in their extreme assertion each of the two great opposites. It is the mind's natural way of returning more perfectly to the affirmation it has lost. On the road, it may attempt to rest in the intervening degrees, reducing all things into the terms of an original life energy, or of sensation, or of ideas. But these exclusive solutions have always an air of unreality. They may satisfy for a time the logical reason which deals only with pure ideas, but they cannot satisfy the mind's sense of actuality. For the mind knows that there is something behind itself which is not the idea. It knows, on the other hand, that there is something within itself which is more than the vital breath. Either spirit or matter can give it, for a time, some sense of ultimate reality. Not so any of the principles that intervene. It must therefore go to the two extremes before it can return fruitfully upon the whole. For by its very nature, served by a sense that can perceive with distinctness only the parts of existence, and by a speech that also can achieve distinctiveness only when it carefully divides and limits, the intellect is driven, having before it this multiplicity of elemental principles, to seek unity by reducing all ruthlessly to the terms of one. It attempts practically, in order to assert this one, to get rid of the others. To perceive the real source of their identity without this exclusive process, it must either have overleaped itself or must have completed the circuit only to find that all equally reduce themselves to that which escapes definition or description and is yet not only real but attainable. By whatever road we may travel, that is always the end at which we arrive, and we can only escape it by refusing to complete the journey. Now this whole paragraph becomes very vivid only if you have read both history of Western philosophy and Indian philosophy, or if you have traversed psychologically a trauma. You have certain psychological cases. You bring up a child, for example, under the influence of Veda and Upanishads, in which the synthesis is prescribed to the child. And the child grows up in the joy of spirit and matter. And there's a great harmony in life, even in the life pattern that he or the child sees all around. There is the meditation, there is a pursuit of the spirit, and there is cultivation of art and beauty, and cultivation of multifarious activities of life, each one systematically organized and wonderfully arranged. And matter also being given great respect, and everything is in its right place, and even the hurting of a vessel creates a kind of a scratch in the mind of the child. If this kind of care is taken, and if you educate the child and grows up to the age of 10, 11, 12, the mind is so balanced, so happy. Everywhere there is joy in life. And then suddenly the child is taken out of this beautiful environment and thrown into a land which is foreign. He won't understand what is all this life. There is a nightclub, and there is the shopping, and there is cinema, and there is a kind of a neglect of everything in the world, and a pursuit only of pleasure all around. There's a great disturbance which takes place to the psychological condition. He does not yet know that he was in a great sense of harmony in his childhood. And suddenly now he's in a world which is quite different. What happens to that child? How will he recover that synthesis which has been lost? He will have to go through a process. He will examine, is this what he sees? Is this really the final ultimate? And he will try to see that, yes, that is the ultimate, and will examine everything in that life to be the ultimate meaning. Until he is told, no. Matter is not the only thing. Pleasure is not the only thing. There are noble ends, some idealism. And then he says, then if idealism, to what extent idealism? Full idealism, partial idealism? He goes through a kind of a terrain of various philosophies of idealism, because even in idealism there are various alternatives: subjective idealism, objective idealism, absolute idealism, and various kinds of idealisms. And then somebody says, no, neither matter is real nor ideal is real. Life burst. Élan vital of Bergson. That is the real thing. Matter is also useless. Mind is also useless. It is a life bursting which is the real. And he examines everything in terms of that. And he finds even that is not satisfying. Then he says, oh, you go into meditation, transcendental meditation. Only that is real. All this is wrong. All this is false. And the child withdraws. Within 7-8 years, he grows up. Something what happens to Siddhartha in this novel Siddhartha. And he says, I can think, I can meditate. And then he enters into the life of thinking and meditation and sees he wants to go to Darjeeling and wants to go to Tiger Hills and wants to go to the Himalayas and seek a complete solution, solitude. He examines that also and then he says, but if all this is real, what about all that he has left behind? What about those experiences of life force, of cinema and pleasure and all that? How to reconcile this? It is when this movement becomes acute, then one returns back again to that. having reached where everything becomes reconciled in the right place. Now this story of the child is actually the story of India and the world. This is what has happened. There has been this experimentation, and we are all at present in a disturbed condition, consciously. In our consciousness, there is not that reconciliation, not that harmony, that synthesis, except for Parjanya. She is the only child among all of us here who is leading a very balanced and very spiritual and material life of fullness, in which there is joy here and joy there and joy everywhere. But as far as we all are concerned, we have been divided. And we are living in a great tension of division. We represent today the great experiment of India and the great experiment of Europe put together and yet unreconciled. This is what Sri Aurobindo now describes here. It is therefore of good augury that after many experiments and verbal solutions, we should now find ourselves standing today in the presence of the two that have alone borne for long the most rigorous tests of experience, the two extremes, and that at the end of the experience, both should have come to a result with the universal instinct in mankind, that veiled judge, sentinel and representative of the universal spirit of truth, refuses to accept as right or as satisfying. In Europe and in India, respectively, the negation of the materialists and the refusal of the ascetic have sought to assert themselves as the sole truth and to dominate the conception of life. In India, if the result has been a great heaping up of the treasures of the spirit, or of some of them, it has also been a great bankruptcy of life. In Europe, the fullness of riches and the triumphant mastery of this world's powers and possessions have progressed towards an equal bankruptcy in the things of the spirit. Nor has the intellect, which sought the solution of all problems in the one term of matter, found satisfaction in the answer that it has received. Therefore, the time grows ripe, and the tendency of the world moves towards a new and comprehensive affirmation in thought and in inner and outward experience, and to its corollary, a new and rich self-fulfillment in an integral human existence for the individual and for the race. It is against this background that the attempt to make a complete reconciliation is found to be inevitable and necessary. The whole world today is seeking a balance, without even knowing, because the tension of both is great. And the whole world is in a state of unrest and a kind of a pain, psychological pain, whether we understand that pain or not. But that pain is present in the life both of East and the West. And therefore we have got to find a reconciliation. And it is toward that reconciliation that this book presents the right method of reconciliation, something that fulfills the truth of matter and the truth of the spirit. Now, in this truth of matter and the truth of the spirit, the conclusion is not that both are equally true. To say that spirit is real and matter is real, when we use the word real, and if you merely state that both are equally real, then the problem is very difficult, irreconcilable. The reconciliation implies a harmonious relationship. There is a special relationship of spirit to the ultimate and of matter to the ultimate. Both spirit and matter are two terms, and both are related to a reality, which is Paratpara. Upanishad does not merely speak of para, it speaks of Paratpara. Paratpara is that which transcends the transcendental. Spirit transcends matter, therefore spirit is para. But ultimate reality is Paratpara. It transcends even spirit, which transcends matter. Therefore, there is a relationship between the spirit and the Paratpara, and matter with the Paratpara. And that relationship is not the same as Paratpara has with the spirit, and the Paratpara has relationship with the matter. They are not of both equal kind of relationship. There is a relationship, but of a different kind. And that subtlety Sri Aurobindo now speaks to us about. All right. Thank you. As I said, there is a difference between the relationship that spirit has to the Paratpara, which Sri Aurobindo calls it here the unknowable, and the relationship that matter has with the unknowable. On account of that difference of relationship, the effectivity of affirmation of spirits and affirmation of matter has also difference. Similarly, the negativity that spiritual negation has towards matter is more effective, more everlasting than the negation that matter gives against the spirit. As Sri Aurobindo says, matter denying spirit is immediately successful, because affirmation of matter is as easy as kicking a football. It can affirm matter so easily. But the negation it makes of the spirit, although immediately you can negate it, but you can't sustain that negativity so long. Therefore, the period of materialists denying the spirit, although effective, it is comparatively short-lived. The spirit denying matter is more difficult. But once it has done it, its effectivity is much greater. Therefore, when we try to understand materialism, we have to understand its force in relationship to the negation that spirit makes of matter. And this chapter, which is devoted to the consideration of the denial of the materialist, in a sense, we might say, Sri Aurobindo says, it is not so difficult to defeat the materialist negation. And that is what Sri Aurobindo is doing in this chapter. It is easier to refute materialism than to refute spirituality. It is extremely difficult to deny the spiritualist. Ultimately, neither can be denied, but if there is an exclusivism of spirit or matter, then the refutation of spirituality is more difficult. The refutation of materialist is much easier. And this is the point that Sri Aurobindo is now making. From the difference in the relations of spirit and matter to the unknowable, which they both represent, there arises also a difference of effectiveness in the material and the spiritual negations. The denial of the materialist, although more insistent and immediately successful, more facile in its appeal to the generality of mankind, is yet less enduring, less effective, finally, than the absorbing and perilous refusal of the ascetic. For it, that is to say materialism, carries within itself its own cure. Its most powerful element is the agnosticism, which, admitting the unknowable behind all manifestation, extends the limits of the unknowable until it comprehends all that is merely unknown. Its premise is that the physical senses are our sole means of knowledge, and that reason, therefore, even in its most extended and vigorous flights, cannot escape beyond that domain. It must deal always and solely with the facts which they provide or suggest. And the suggestions themselves must always be kept tied to their origins. We cannot go beyond. We cannot use them as a bridge leading us into a domain where more powerful and less limited faculties come into play, and another kind of inquiry has to be instituted. Now, in this paragraph, apart from saying that materialism is less difficult to refute, Sri Aurobindo gives us in a few lines a cogent and accurate enunciation of materialism. What is materialism? Normally, when we speak of materialism in common parlance, we do not go to the metaphysical aspect of materialism, but we speak of the influence materialism has on life. We normally say the pursuit of success, of money, pleasure, is all materialistic. This is how, in common parlance, we understand the word materialism. But that is only the effect of materialism on life. The basic premise and basic conclusion of materialism is that matter is the only ultimate reality. This is materialism. Matter is the only ultimate reality. This is the assertion of materialism. Matter is the only real. On what grounds can this theory stand? How do you prove that matter is ultimately real? It is in that context that Sri Aurobindo gives us a clear enunciation of materialism. Materialism has a premise and a conclusion. The starting point of the argument and then the conclusion. What is the starting point of materialism? It says that our physical senses are the means of knowledge. All our knowledge is derived from our physical senses. Therefore, the only thing that we can see is matter. Physical senses can only see matter. Therefore, what is demonstrable, provable to exist, is matter. So, the premise is that physical senses are the sole means of our knowledge. Therefore, the only thing that we can see is matter. Therefore, matter is the only thing that we can demonstrate. Therefore, matter alone exists. This is the whole argument. So, read again the premise. Its premise is that physical senses are our sole means of knowledge, and that reason, therefore, even in its most extended and vigorous flights, cannot escape beyond their domain. It must deal always and solely with the facts which they provide or suggest. They mean senses. And the suggestions themselves must always be kept tied to their origins. We cannot go beyond. We cannot use them as a bridge leading us into a domain where more powerful and less limited faculties come into play and another kind of inquiry has to be instituted. Now, to understand fully this statement, we have to visit many systems of philosophy which are called materialistic. Materialism has been in the world right from earliest times. Even in ancient Greece, there was materialistic philosophy of Chrysippus and Democritus. In India, Charvaka is a very famous materialist philosopher. And this philosophy at one time was not very popular. In Greece, materialism was not very popular. There was a great deal of belief in gods and goddesses in the ancient Greek culture, and therefore materialism did not have much role to play. In India too, although Charvaka system did play a role, the major tendencies of philosophy were all spiritualistic. The six orthodox systems of philosophy, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, Purva Mimamsa and Uttar Mimamsa, and Jainism and Buddhism, these all were spiritualistic philosophies. And they have played a very major role in Indian philosophy. In a sense, you might say that in India, there has never been a highly materialistic trend of thought. India has rather been more conservative in respect of the spirit. But in the West, after the Greek decline, although Romans conquered Greece and there was a new civilization which came up, Greco-Roman civilization, and although this civilization had a lot to do with gods and goddesses, because even Romans added their own gods and goddesses to the pantheon of the Greeks. The materialism was manifest in the licenses of life that we found both in Greece and Rome. They were not materialistic philosophies, but life was materialistic. And then, of course, there came up a big wave of Christianity in the time of the Romans. And Christianity played a great role in rejecting materialism for a long time. But this philosophy of materialism began to come into prominence in the Western philosophy with the growth of what is called empiricism. Empiricism was first formulated and articulated powerfully by Locke, and it came to be culminated in the philosophy of Hume. These two philosophers gave a great impetus to the growth of modern materialism, because they maintained that our means of knowledge have to be tested. What can we know? How do we know? Should be asked as a central question of inquiry before we discuss God and the world and man and his duty. Because knowledge of God, is it ever possible? Mind you, Locke himself believed in God, but he started this questioning, and his starting point was that we must inquire into human understanding. What does human being understand? What can he understand? What is the beginning of his understanding? What is the height of his understanding? That was his basic inquiry. And right from that time, what we say epistemology, the science of inquiry into knowledge, became prominent in the West. And till today, that trend of epistemology continues to be very strong. In fact, epistemology began to grow more and more powerful, and today epistemology is considered to be the most important domain of inquiry. Even till today, the starting point of Locke is still being referred to as a starting point of epistemology. The question was, how do we know? What is knowledge? And two primary propositions which were made by him were that we are aware of ideas in our mind. When we speak of knowledge, normally we speak in terms of ideas. So he asked the question, what are the ideas and how do the ideas occur in the mind? All our understanding is an understanding through ideas. And the question is, how do ideas occur? Now, he started by saying that all ideas are actually derived from sense experience. When you open our eyes and open our senses to the multifarious things which are happening in the world, we receive so many impacts upon what we think is mind. Now, he assumed that mind, to begin with, is tabula rasa, is a blank slate. That was his assumption, right or wrong. And later on, this assumption has been questioned But he started by saying that mind, to begin with, of a child is tabula rasa, is a blank slate. And the ideas grow into the mind depending upon the kind of sensations that you throw upon the child's senses. And gradually, these impressions are received in the mind as images, first of all. Just as we close our eyes after seeing an image, and the image still seems to continue, and we still perceive the images. So he said that all the sensations are received in our brain or mind as images. These images, to begin with, are vivid images, live images, and gradually they fade out and they become faint images. Now, these faint images become still fainter and fainter and still fainter until they become ideas. So, ideas are, according to Locke, only the faintest images of sense impressions. And then we begin to combine and associate these ideas, and as a result of this, there is a big tree grown, as it were, in our mind, which consists of a number of ideas and their connections and interconnections. Therefore, now when you speak of the word reason, the question was for Locke to say, what is reason then? So reason is simply a coordinating agency. The ideas, the images are received in the brain. These images become ideas, and then they begin to be coordinated. Now for coordinating images, reason is capable of creating what may be called labels of classification. So the function of reason is simply the function of classification. Actually speaking, even this question needs to be asked, but it was not asked. What is this classification? How this idea of classification arose at all in the mind? But that question was kept separate. It is now that we can question more insistently. But it was felt that there is something like power of classification. So reason is simply a classifier of ideas. And as a result of classificatory process, there are connections made. Of course, it seems that while doing so, you seem to be going far, far from images. Therefore, ideas may seem to be quite different from the images that you have received. So you take the something which is very, very far from images. Ideas are sometimes so remote that you may not find any example in the world corresponding to that idea. Therefore, even if you go in the highest flights of reason, those flights may seem to be very far from the physical images that you have seen. Locke maintained that ultimately they are reducible back to those images. And no idea in reason can ultimately be called to be so remote as to be not reducible to those images that we primarily receive from the senses. That was what is called empirical theory. That is, you derive from experience. Empiricism is a theory of knowledge derivable from experience. So, this empiricist thought, which started with Locke, became more and more powerful in the history of Western thought. And today, empiricism is one of the most powerful theory of epistemology even today. And since empiricism starts with sense knowledge, and therefore sense experience, and since senses only recognize matter, it argues that the only thing that we can demonstrate, prove, is the existence of matter. So, premise of materialism is that senses are the means of knowledge, the only means of knowledge, and therefore the reason, even in its highest flights, cannot go beyond the images received from the senses. And therefore the only reality we can affirm is matter. Therefore matter alone is real. This is the whole doctrine of materialism fundamentally. Secondly, that there is no way to bridge. There is no way to bridge whatever is received by senses with anything that is supposed to be received by other means. That is to say, if anybody says that such and such idea came to me not from senses, but from something else, and whatever may be regarded as a source of it, in the Western tradition it was said that certain ideas came from revelation. Not from sense experience, but revelation. And the empiricist argued that those sources of revelations and these senses, there is no bridge between the two. Therefore, you cannot even infer a connection between this source of knowledge and the other source of knowledge. The other source of knowledge is hardly available to anybody. Therefore, the question of inquiry into it also could not be raised. So, materialism in this form became more and more dominant, and even today, it is a very powerful trend of thought. This is all that materialism ultimately has to say. There is a sense experience which you cannot deny. Our knowledge is built on sense experience. Sense experience can take cognizance only of matter. Therefore, the only thing that we can see is matter. Anything that we can demonstrate to be existing truly is only matter. Therefore, matter alone exists. Now, Sri Aurobindo says that the very premise with which you start is arbitrary. This is the criticism now. A premise so arbitrary, Sri Aurobindo says, a premise so arbitrary pronounces on itself its own sentence of insufficiency. I would like to dwell upon this sentence because this is the, you might say, a refutation of materialism. An arbitrary premise. When do you call a premise as arbitrary? An arbitrary statement is a statement which is taken up at random, without reason or rhyme. You take up a statement out of many statements which are available, then that statement is called arbitrary. Supposing you hear a conversation between two people, and I ask you, what is the conversation going on? Oh, they are speaking of shopping. Now, that may be only one word used by in conversation. There may be something else which is being talked. But a statement is taken up. That is called arbitrary, and to therefore to say that gives the summary of the whole conversation, it would be quite wrong. Now, if you are asked a question, how do we know? Now, there is no doubt about the fact that senses are the means of knowledge. But Did you ask the question, is it the sole means of knowledge? Did you inquire how many different sources of knowledge are available? That senses are the means of knowledge? Granted. But unless you have considered different sources of knowledge, and having rejected all others, and stating this is the right way, unless you prove it, it is arbitrary. Now, empiricism does not merely say that senses are our means of knowledge. It says our senses are the sole means of knowledge, and that makes a lot of difference. If it was said that senses are the means of knowledge, or one of the means of knowledge, it would not be arbitrary. But if you say senses are the only means of knowledge, it's an arbitrary statement because you have not counted other sources of knowledge. There are other sources of knowledge. Or there can be claims of many other sources of knowledge. Since that has not been considered by empiricism, this statement of empiricism is an arbitrary statement. It is taken up at random. It is a statement which passes insufficiency. It's not complete falsity, but insufficiency. Because it is true that senses are means of knowledge. So, it is not a false statement, but it is insufficient. So, Sri Aurobindo says that a premise so arbitrary pronounces on itself its own sentence of insufficiency. Now, this particular statement is further enunciated and elucidated in the next chapter. So, I will take you to there. I don't know what is page number, but if you see the next chapter, and if you turn to the third paragraph, that is to say, why, what justification? Or fourth paragraph, you might say, because the first line is one paragraph by itself. So, fourth paragraph, what justification? Have you got it? Now there, you see the third line. The world of matter is affirmed by the experience of the physical senses, which, because they are themselves unable to perceive anything immaterial or not organized as gross matter, would persuade us that the supraphysical is the unreal. This is another form of materialistic statement. The world of matter is affirmed by the experience of the physical senses, which, because they are themselves unable to perceive anything immaterial, senses can't perceive anything that is immaterial, therefore the senses would persuade us that the suprasensible is unreal. This is a jump in the conclusion. Because the physical senses cannot grasp anything that is supraphysical, therefore, the empiric theory, which says that physical senses are the means of knowledge, and since supraphysical realities cannot be grasped by the physical, therefore it says the supraphysical is unreal. Now, Sri Aurobindo says, just as there he spoke of arbitrary premise, now Sri Aurobindo uses a much more vigorous term here. This vulgar or rustic error of our corporeal organs does not gain in validity by being promoted into the domain of philosophical reasoning. Sri Aurobindo says that this particular statement is very often tom-tommed as a great philosophical statement. And Sri Aurobindo says that actually speaking, it is a rustic error, an error which only a villager can make, not an instructed person, not an educated person, a rustic error. And to put this rustic error into a high position as of a philosophy, Sri Aurobindo says we have to expose this philosophy and the error in it. It's a rustic error. It is like a villager who is for the first time brought on a railway platform where he sees an engine rushing with a train on the platform. And what does he see? A villager who is for the first time brought on a railway platform where he sees an engine rushing with a train on the platform. And what does he see? He sees that there is a piston which is going up and down. And whenever the piston moves, the steam comes out. He concludes that piston is the cause of the vapor, of the steam. And he says, wherever there is a piston, there is a steam. If you are instructed, friend of that villager, he will tell him, my dear friend, the truth is quite the opposite. The piston itself would not be able to move if there was no steam power first. It is because of steam power that the piston is moving up and down. And even then he will not accept you, because actually outwardly he only sees the piston moving and the steam coming out. Until you take him into the engine, show him how water is heated up and how the heated water produces the steam, and by the steam power the piston is moved. Until you show all this, he wouldn't be persuaded. But nonetheless, the statement that he had made was a rustic error. Now that rustic error being promoted into a philosophical reasoning, and to say, look, this is a philosophical reasoning, Sri Aurobindo says this vulgar mistake should not be elevated into a high position of a philosophical reasoning. There we saw it was an arbitrary statement. Now Sri Aurobindo speaks of it as a rustic error. Materialism is a rustic error. Now, Sri Aurobindo says, obviously, their pretension is unfounded. Even in the world of matter, there are existences of which the physical senses are incapable of taking cognizance. Yet, denial of the supersensible as necessarily an illusion or a hallucination depends on this constant sensuous association with the real, with the materially perceptible, which is itself a hallucination. Just as perception of steam coming out of the piston movement is a hallucination, is the opposite of the reality. Similarly, all that we see in the world physically can be regarded as something hallucinatory from the point of view of spiritual consciousness, a dream consciousness. Now, if therefore the two propositions are compared with each other, then you find that materialist is assuming what he wants to prove. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, second proposition he makes, assuming throughout what it seeks to establish, it is the vice of the argument in a circle and can have no validity for an impartial reasoning. Now, in logic, there is what is called circular reasoning. And circular reasoning is regarded as a fallacy. You are in philosophy, in a true metaphysical philosophy, not permitted to have a circular reasoning. A circular reasoning is one in which the premise and the conclusion are the same. You may use other different words, but if you examine, the assumption and the conclusion are the same. You start by saying that physical senses are the only means of knowledge. If you ask the question, why is it so? Why is it that physical senses are the only means of knowledge? The answer would be because matter alone is real. Why is it that physical senses are the only means of knowledge? If it was to say that physical senses are the means of knowledge, there is no problem. But if you say physical senses are the only means of knowledge, and if you ask the question, why is it so? The only answer that the empiricist gives is that because only physical is the only reality, there cannot be another thing. There can't be other means of knowledge because matter is the only real. And if you say, how do you prove that matter alone is real? Because only physical senses are the only means of knowledge. So, when you ask this question, then that is the assumption. When you ask this assumption, then that is the only answer. It is called argument in a circle. You don't come out of it. If it was said, matter is real, why? Because matter is seen. No problem. But materialism doesn't say that. It says, matter alone is real. Why? Because matter alone is seen. And why is matter alone seen? Because matter alone is real. This is the reasoning, and therefore Sri Aurobindo says, this is no philosophical reasoning. And therefore, it should be banished from philosophical reasoning. It has a place, this reasoning can be a place, in a theory of chance. Where you do not have reasoning at all, in a theory of chance, there is no reasoning. Anything can happen, you are only to observe whatever happens. But if you are a philosophic reasoning, where the reasoning is allowed, reasoning must have a kind of a certain system in which you can't put effect as a cause and cause an effect. There is a relationship between the two, and that relationship has to be observed. You can't say it happens, therefore it is so. In a philosophic reasoning, the argument from the conclusion as a premise and derivation of a premise from the conclusion is a fallacious movement, and therefore it has no philosophic grounding. So Sri Aurobindo says, actually speaking, materialism is so easy to refute. It is arbitrary, it's a vulgar mistake, and has no basis for philosophical reasoning. It is so easy to argue, Sri Aurobindo says. Now Sri Aurobindo says, continuing the same paragraph, new paragraph, not only are there physical realities which are suprasensible, but if evidence and experience are at all a test of truth, there are also senses which are supraphysical and can not only take cognizance of the realities of the material world without the aid of the corporeal sense organs, but can bring us into contact with other realities, supraphysical and belonging to another world. included, that is to say, in an organization of conscious experiences that are dependent on some other principle than gross matter of which our suns and earth seem to be made. So there are, first of all, even in the physical world, there are supraphysical realities. There are in the physical world which are suprasensible. Take, for example, we are now told in the modern science that this physical world that we see is four-dimensional. Our normal physical sense is only three dimensions physically. We see the height, depth, and breadth. That is our limitation of our physical perception. But now we are told that time also is a dimension of physical reality. And time cannot be physically seen. But it's a physical reality. So, how do we perceive time? We cannot physically see time. So even in the physical reality, there are suprasensible realities. This is now very well seen. Therefore, the argument that only physical senses are the only means of knowledge, that cannot anymore be sustained. Even if at one time it was argued quite seriously, but in the modern times when we have come to realize that even in the physical realities, there are suprasensible realities. They are physical in nature, but they are suprasensible. They cannot be perceived by physical senses at all. Then there are many other phenomena. Experiments were made by a man who was blindfolded and was asked to ride on motorbike and go around the whole town, and he could do it to prove that he had supraphysical senses. He could see accurately the physical world without what we consider to be the indispensable physical senses. Now, it may not be a common experience, but even if in one experience it is possible, it can be seen that the physical world can be seen by supraphysical senses. There is a supraphysical senses. There are senses which are supraphysical. You can see, that is to say, there are sensations of hearing. You can hear which is inaudible. You can see what is invisible. You can touch what is intangible. Now, if these facts, in fact, in modern times, these facts are demonstrated. It is no more merely a few mystics here and there seeing all this. Even experiments have been carried out and these things have been shown. So it is easier for us now to say that this pretension of empiricism is no more sustainable. Of course, there are still empiricists who are not convinced. Sri Aurobindo goes farther. Constantly assaulted by human experience and belief, since the origin of thought, this truth, now that the necessity of an exclusive preoccupation with the secrets of the material world no longer exists, begins to be justified by newborn forms of scientific research. The increasing evidences, of which only the most obvious and outward are established under the name of telepathy, with its cognate phenomena, cannot long be resisted except by minds shut up in the brilliant shell of the past, by intellects limited in spite of their acuteness through the limitation of their field of experience and inquiry, or by those who confuse enlightenment and reason with the faithful repetition of the formulas left to us from a bygone century and the jealous conservation of dead or dying intellectual dogmas. As I said, in spite of these evidences, there are still empirists today who refuse to accept, as we saw yesterday from Bertrand Russell, that we refuse to believe that there are other faculties. So Sri Aurobindo gives a very drastic judgment on these people, who even when this research has been done, evidences have been brought up, even then they say, oh no, we can't accept. Sometime it might have happened in one case, two cases, three cases, but I have not seen it. Until I see it, I will not accept it. As though in every case, everything that he comes to believe, he has seen himself. But when you argue with him, he says, but I have not seen, honestly, how can I accept God's existence? I have never seen him myself. Oh, this mystic might have seen, that mystic might have seen, Saint Teresa might have seen, Mirabai must have seen here in India. I have not seen, so until I have seen, how can I accept it? He applies now a different criterion of truth and knowledge. Normally, if scientists agree that they have seen, you agree that yes, it must be so. I might not have seen what is a planet beyond my galaxy. But if a scientist says there exists, I begin to accept. Why? Because of whatever prestige he occupies in the world. But when it comes to such beliefs as supraphysical facts and the experiences of supraphysical facts, these facts are being denied by hard-hearted empiricists. And therefore Sri Aurobindo gives epithets for them, that they are denied by those who confuse enlightenment and reason with the faithful repetition of the formulas left to us from the bygone century and the jealous conservation of dead or dying intellectual dogmas. Empiricism is basically a dogma. It simply says physical are the only means of knowledge without proving that physical are the only means of knowledge. You can say this statement only when you have seen other means of knowledge and said that these means are not means of knowledge, then only you can say that physical are the only means of knowledge, which you have not done. What you have done is the physical are the means of knowledge. Fine, it is correct. But the premise is that physical means are the only means of knowledge. So Sri Aurobindo's conclusion is that this is a very easy refutation of materialism. Now we come back again to where we were. A premise so arbitrary pronounces on itself its own sentence of insufficiency. It can only be maintained by ignoring or explaining away all that vast field of evidence and experience which contradicts it. Denying or disparaging noble and useful faculties, active consciously or obscurely, or at worst latent in all human beings, and refusing to investigate supraphysical phenomena, except as manifested in relation to matter and its movements, and conceived as a subordinate activity of material forces. As soon as we begin to investigate the operations of mind and of supermind in themselves and without the prejudgment that is determined from the beginning to see in them only a subordinate term of matter, we come into contact with a mass of phenomena which escape entirely from the rigid hold, the limiting dogmatism of the materialist formula. The mass of phenomena are available when we discuss and investigate the experiences of the supraphysical. If you see Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, the longest book in Savitri is entitled The Experiences of the Traveler, Traveler of the Worlds. And there is a store of all the evidences that we get of the supraphysical senses. There is a long travel of Ashwapati in the story, where Ashwapati, he rises from plane to plane, from matter to subtle matter, then to the life plane, and several layers of the life plane, then to the plane of the mind, and different planes of the mind, and then still higher planes of supermind, and right up to the transcendental. It's a long chain of statements concerning supraphysical experiences. If anybody says, I want to have a storehouse of descriptions of all these supraphysical experiences, Sri Aurobindo has given profusion of these descriptions and accurate descriptions. The entire space and time, which is not this space and time, which is true of the physical world. Even ordinary human beings, all of us, are constantly in the experiences of dreams. And we rarely ask the question, what are the dreams? In the dreams, my eyes are closed. There is no doubt about it. And yet I see different colors in dreams and vivid colors. By what senses do I see them? If physical senses are the sole means of experience and knowledge, we should ask simple question, by what senses do I see the colors? My physical hearing is closed because if somebody shouts, I cannot hear. But I do dialogue and hear my dialogues in the dream. So my physical awareness is closed, but there is a dialogue going on in my supraphysical experience. I travel, even though I am lying in the bed, I am traveling all around. How do I travel? How do I experience? How can I exchange with people? If you simply analyze only dream experiences which are available to all of us, the premise of materialists is immediately overpassed. The materialist can never explain the dream experiences. Of course, he says they're all after images. But even after images, he cannot take, the theory cannot take as long, because you see in the dreams which you have not seen here in this world. You see different kinds of flowers which are never seen in this world. You have different kinds of perfumes which are not in the physical world. You see figures which you do not see figures here in this world at all. How do I experience them? What is the origin of all this? So as soon as you begin to examine even dream experience, the materialist formula is broken. But when you go into deeper and higher realms, When you can consciously travel, as Sri Aurobindo says, Ashwapati travels and gives a description of all his travels, it may be that only Ashwapati could do, you and I cannot do. But if one human being can do scientifically, it has a great value. And if 10 people can do, if not all the people, but 10 people can do, it has a still a greater evidence. And if 100 people can do, a greater evidence. So, now these experiences of the supraphysical worlds, if you combine, there have been 4 important domains in the history of the world where supraphysical worlds have been traveled by a number of individuals. Not only a few here and there. If you take the whole world history, all religions have produced human beings who have testified to have had experiences which are supraphysical. Whether it was in Egyptian religion, or in Vedic religion, or Chaldean religion, Babylonian religion, wherever, all religions have given evidences of human beings who have had supraphysical experiences. And their experiences can be compared. Now we have got a lot of data about it. In the Veda, for example, there are dialogues of gods and men. We may think they are all imaginary fictions, but that was not the view of Agastya himself, who has written the dialogue. You must ask him, is it merely a fictitious dialogue? He doesn't write it as a fictitious dialogue. It was a real dialogue between him and Indra. He has met Indra, discussed with him, obtained knowledge from him. Similarly, there has been a great deal of occultism in the world. Not religions, but occultism. There have been hundreds and thousands of occultists in the history of occultism, and whose experiences are extraordinary experiences. Even today, for example, there are a large number of books written on occultism, although not sufficiently respected, but that is a different matter. The fact is that lots of books which have been written in theosophical literature, for example, all theosophists believe in occult experiences. And there have been a great deal of literature collected even the last century in the world in the theosophical movement. All philosophies, even materialists, have been obliged to accept the data of the supraphysical realities. Even though the materialistic philosophy has been obliged to reject it, but reject after taking cognizance of it. They cannot say we have not heard of occult realities at all. So even philosophy is a witness to a large number of supraphysical experiences. And spiritual history, of course, abounds with spiritual experiences, which are all supraphysical. All great saints of the world have encountered spiritual reality, and their descriptions are available. So Sri Aurobindo says, as soon as we examine the records of experiences of the mind and of the supermind, the premise of materialism collapses, which says the physical means are the only means of knowledge. Now, having done this, the last sentence of the paragraph, and the moment we recognize, as our enlarging experience compels us to recognize, that there are in the universe knowable realities beyond the range of the senses, and in man powers and faculties which determine rather than are determined by the material organs through which they hold themselves in touch with the world of the senses, that outer shell of our true and complete existences, the premise of materialistic agnosticism disappears. We are ready for a large statement and an ever-developing inquiry. Once we get rid of this basic premise that material senses are the only means of knowledge, then we enter into larger fields of inquiry. The modern man has not yet entered into it because this premise is still lingering. Although that premise is now not being advanced so vehemently as at one time, it was being advanced. In fact, the latest scientists have begun to admit something which they were very, very shy to admit. They do believe and they do recognize that this physical body, which consists of cells and trillions of cells, that these cells are organized. And that are so organized that there is an automatic machinery in it of ensuring that the health of the body is maintained as far as possible. That there are systems by which if anything goes wrong into the movement of the cells, there is a trigger automatic by which repair is immediately attempted and ultimately effected. As it is said, even a wound inflicted anywhere, immediately the white cells of the blood rush up. As if there is a recognition in the very mechanism of the body itself, as if there is a recognition itself in the body, which is supposed to be unconscious, of something to be done and to be repaired. Now these phenomena are now perfectly admitted, and there are brain scientists today who, although they believe that thought is simply a movement of the brain, physical brain, they are now no more so sure. They feel it's a kind of a mystery and a miracle that something else is happening. It is almost like a villager who was under the impression that piston was the cause of the steam, now coming across the fact that actually piston itself is moved by the steam. So now when he examines actually the movements of the brain, he finds that instead of the brain moving the thought, it is a thought which is moving the brain. This kind of suspicion is beginning to gain ground even in the physical sciences. The latest psychologists or biologists particularly, we have a very great friend called Professor P.N. Tandon. He is in India the topmost brain scientist. And he has collected a lot of data which show that mere brain movement cannot explain itself, and that there are evidently certain movements which are required to be explained only in terms which are not physiological. Recently, certain other books also have come out, like Penrose. He is one of the very eminent scientists. And he has made a long statement that we have got to recognize the presence of something which we have so far ignored, namely the presence of consciousness. In the movements of matter, in the movements of the body. And this can no more be denied. Of course, there are scientists who do not agree with Penrose. But the increasing number of scientists are now beginning to realize that the phenomena of the supraphysical, the phenomena of consciousness, are so powerfully determinant of the physiological happenings, physical happenings, that you've got to take cognizance of it. In fact, some scientists even go so far as to say that already it is established that consciousness is prior to matter. The primacy of consciousness against the primacy of matter is being underlined. Now, there may be an exaggeration one way or the other, but the fact is that today one cannot be dogmatic either way. And increasing evidence shows that the premise of materialism at least collapses. Now, having done this, Sri Aurobindo here, he has given a very brief statement that the moment we examine the operations of the mind and of the supermind, the premise of materialism collapses. In this book, he has not given the story of all the phenomena which are supraphysical, and for that Savitri is to be seen, because Savitri is one document which is full of supraphysical phenomena and accurate descriptions of supraphysical phenomena. In fact, if there is in modern times the most accurate description of different domains of consciousness, it is Savitri. There is no other book in the modern world giving the detailed descriptions of all the supraphysical realities, right from subtle matter up to supramental and the transcendental. All these domains are fully described. This description is a very difficult task, to describe a vital world in the same way in which you see this physical world. Sri Aurobindo has described all these worlds so accurately. So that science exists already to before us. And if anybody really wants to inquire, as Sri Aurobindo says, we are now ready for a new inquiry. And according to Sri Aurobindo, even in the modern world, this inquiry will move very fast, as Sri Aurobindo says. Materialism carries a cure within itself. If materialism were a pure dogma, as sometimes it happens to be a dogma, then of course the inquiry would be greatly disturbed, because a dogma cannot be convinced. But materialism is not a pure dogma. It has also its own openings. And since those openings can be opened up more easily, for scientists, it will be a very fast movement. The moment the border will be crossed between matter and the immaterial, scientists will rush into the vital world and mental world and supramental world with a great speed, which you cannot imagine today. Because once they get a clue, there is one great advantage of scientific spirit in the world today. It is not bound by any dogma. It is not restricted by any statement which says, do not. There is no forbidding. In science, nobody can forbid any inquiry. And that is a tremendous gain of the modern world. And therefore, Sri Aurobindo says that scientists will be the first group of people who will enter into the pure inquiry of the spirit. Their only present is only the shell of the past. Dead dogmatism is the only one which is at present obstructing the path. But once that path is crossed, and this cannot be resisted long, therefore, we are now in a very, very interesting state of inquiry. But, and now the rest of the chapter is given to the praise of materialism. That is to say, materialism has done a great service to the field of inquiry, and that has to be acknowledged. Our search is for the truth, and our truth search must be impartial. Even while we say that materialism is a rustic error and should not be allowed to be promoted to a status of philosophical reasoning, we must admit that materialism is first of all an inquiry, and that this movement of inquiry has done a great service to mankind. What is that great service? That service is to act against superstition, obscurantism. And it has given a tremendous break to many people who are apt to make exaggerated claims of the so-called supraphysical experiences. There are people, even today, even the scientific world, who gain a slight supraphysical experience, and they begin to make exaggerated claims. Somebody might hear a voice for the first time. A supraphysical voice saying, do this or don't do this. And then he begins to claim, I have heard the voice of God. Yes, heard the voice, that is true. But he makes an exaggerated claim. I have heard the voice of God. He might have heard a supraphysical voice. If you are not a good scientist of occultism, you might say that whatever supraphysical voices you hear are only voices of God. As though there are no other voices. Occultism tells us that there are vital voices, mental voices, there are some other beings of many other realms of consciousness. And merely to say that voice of that kind is a voice of God, as if your very first experiment you make in going beyond matter and the very first encounter gives you the voice of God. These kinds of experiences also need to be checked. So this is a great help that materialism has given. By rejecting all supraphysical claims, it says, I will admit your claims only under a very restricted standards of truth and verification. Prove your proposition repeatedly under different circumstances, different kind of tests, methods of agreement, methods of disagreement, all kinds of methods of cause, effect, explanation of this kind, explanation of that kind. Materialism has created a great wall of tests. And you pass through those tests, then only your truth can be admitted. Now it is true that supraphysical realm is a vaster realm than the physical realm. And those who are likely to enter into that realm, not knowing the vastness, even the small vaster vastnesses, will give him a feeling that now there is nothing greater can happen. So make big exaggerated claims of his experiences. So before the world enters into this greater and greater and greater vistas of experiences, it is good that at the very gate materialist stands as a guard and says, be sure and give me complete proof of what you are saying. The erection of all these tests is a very important precaution against exaggerations that can come about. And these exaggerations, if they are not challenged, they are dangerous. The world of physical reality itself is a dangerous world. There are mountains and valleys and there are pits and there are oceans. And all kinds of accidents occur in this physical world itself. But if you enter into the vital world, which is a much larger world, and there the perils of that world are even much greater perils, all kinds of deceptions and falsehoods, all kinds of images, some of which have been described in the acts of Ravana in the Ramayana, what kind of illusions are created by Ravana to delude Rama and Sita. These may be regarded as fictitious imaginations to our present mind. But there have been in the history people capable of creating these deceptions because of their context with the vital world. But in any case, if you enter into the vital world, there are many, many kinds of experiences which are deceptive. And you may remain snared for lives, not only one life, but for lives. And then there are mental worlds. There the littleness of the mind and the vastnesses of the mind, both are available. And you may not know where you are. So unless and until we are sufficiently trained, it is best not to enter into those fields. And materialism has done a great service to mankind by putting a big brake at the very beginning. And it is only now, little by little, with so many tests being created and so many demands of proof being put before any spiritualist or occultist, so Sri Aurobindo now wants to praise the services rendered by materialism, how atheism has played a great service to theism and to God. But first, we should recognize the enormous, the indispensable utility of the very brief period of rationalistic materialism through which humanity has been passing. For that vast field of evidence and experience, which now begins to reopen its gates on us, can only be safely entered when the intellect has been severely trained to a clear austerity. Seized on by unripe minds, it lends itself to the most perilous distortions and misleading imaginations, and actually in the past encrusted a real nucleus of truth with such an accretion of perverting superstitions and irrationalizing dogmas that all advance in true knowledge was rendered impossible. It became necessary for a time to make a clean sweep at once of the truth and its disguise in order that the road might be clear for a new departure and a surer advance. The rationalistic tendency of materialism has done mankind this great service. 4. The faculties that transcend the senses, by the very fact of their being immersed in matter, missioned to work in a physical body, put in harness to draw one car, along with the emotional desires and nervous impulses, are exposed to a mixed functioning, in which they are in danger of illuminating confusion rather than clarifying truths. Especially is this mixed functioning dangerous when men with unchastened minds and unpurified sensibilities attempt to rise into the higher domains of spiritual experience. In what regions of unsubstantial cloud and semi-brilliant fog or a murk visited by flashes which blind more than they enlighten, do they not lose themselves by that rash and premature adventure? An adventure necessary indeed in the way in which nature chooses to effect her advance. For she amuses herself as she works, but still for the reason rash and premature. It is necessary, therefore, that advancing knowledge should base herself on a clear, pure, and disciplined intellect. It is necessary, therefore, that advancing knowledge should base it herself on a clear, pure, and disciplined intellect. It is necessary, too, that she should correct her errors, sometimes by a return to the restraint of the physical facts, sensible facts, the concrete realities of the physical world. The touch of earth is always reinvigorating to the son of earth, even when he seeks a supraphysical knowledge. It may even be said that the supraphysical can only be really mastered in its fullness. To its heights we can always reach when we keep our feet firmly on the physical. Earth is his footing, says the Upanishad, whenever it images a self that manifests in the universe. And it is certainly the fact that the wider we extend and the surer we make our knowledge of the physical world, the wider and surer becomes our foundation for the higher knowledge, even for the highest, even for the Brahma Vidya. So, Brahma Vidya will be still a farther distant goal for the modern man. Before he enters into Brahma Vidya, he will be still confronting many other supraphysical realities. In fact, mobile and other devices which have been created are already the conquest of the supraphysical by the physical. So many supraphysical realities are now caught so easily on your television and on your mobile phone and so on. unimaginable distances are covered within a short time. And even much vaster things are going to happen, of which we cannot dream today. As Sri Aurobindo says, when the vital world will be examined, what realities will be manifested, what uses can be made of this vital world. Great perils also are awaiting from the point of view of the safety of mankind. And when we enter into mental world, greater mysteries will be revealed, and then will be Brahma Vidya, the supreme knowledge of the Brahman itself. So we are in a great train. So before we enter into all these different worlds, it is best that materialism trains us rigorously into the science of testing, so that we do not fly into imagination, into obscurities and superstitions. I think we can stop here now, already 2 o'clock. All right.